Happy Sunday, happy Mother's Day, and welcome to another milk curdling episode of Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Ann Saxelby. Our producer today is Jack Inslee, and our engineer is Nat Wiener. And I would like to thank our sponsor for today's show, which is none other than my mother, Pam Saxelby, who has sponsored this show with her blog, How Not to Raise Effed Up Adults. How Not to Raise Effed Up Adults, notice there's no profanity here, is a blog written by Pam Saxelby, an educator and mother of three healthy adult children. I'm glad she said that. The blog is a running commentary on how not to mess up your children too much. Whether you're a concerned parent or a tormented child, these stories can teach you something about life, parenting, and growing up. Check it out at http://saxelbypam.blogspot.com. Thanks, Mom, for being my mom and for sponsoring today's show. So today on Cutting the Curd, apropos of Mother's Day, we're going to dive into the world of milk with my guest, John Bunting, who knows more about the dairy industry than just about anybody that I know. The world of dairy that I know through my business, selling Farmstead cheese and other fresh dairy products, is a far cry from the reality of most dairy farmers' reality in the United States. The farms that I work with work very hard, but they're able to make a living doing it because they sell their products pretty much directly to consumers through my shop, but it's a very short distribution chain. But most dairy farmers in the United States work very hard and don't even make enough money to break even every year. And we're going to talk with John to see what's behind our national dairyscape and just sort of talk about problems and possible solutions. So thanks for joining us today, John.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here. You sound like you have a great mother.
I do. I'm really lucky. She's a good one.
Great.
She didn't blink when I told her that I wanted to go work on a dairy farm after I graduated from art school.
That's wonderful.
So can you tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to be involved with the dairy industry just about your background in general?
Well, my background in general ends up being so terribly eclectic, but for years I have owned cows and been a dairy farmer. And back in the 80s, I realized that I didn't know how the milk in my bulk tank, where it's stored until it's picked up, was priced, even though people use generic terms like supply and demand and so forth. So I began this quest to find out what was happening. I also noticed that farm after farm was disappearing. You know, right now, if you drive through rural New York, it looks like a war zone. And that's primarily because we have been the third largest dairy state in the country. And so dairy farms are terribly critical to the rural landscape. They disappeared. So
now, you're in Delaware County, is that right?
Yes, which is the western foothills of the Catskills. It touches Pennsylvania in the south and is the headwaters of the Delaware River. The water that is drunk in New York City, in large part, comes from the Delaware River watershed.
That also makes that area particularly prime for dairying, right? Because the land does have a lot of water. It's great grazing land.
Well, yes. You know, the people that originally settled this county came from Scotland, victims of what was known as the Enclosures Act. In other words, they didn't come here willingly. They came primarily to America as indentured servants, worked off their indentureship after about 13 years, and saved up some money and came here to buy what was then relatively cheap land, which was, as I say, the western foothills of the Catskills. Our barn is at 1,600 feet elevation, and our top meadow is at 2,200 feet of elevation. So, you know, it's really like some of where the finer cheeses in Europe are produced, or in alpine regions, or in mountainous, semi-mountainous regions. So that's what Delaware County is. I have a book that was written in 1923 simply titled The Cow. And the author begins talking about the fertile plain, primarily the Mohawk Valley, winding its way up through to Delaware County, the kingdom of the cow. And 75 years ago, the Delaware County was the lead dairy county of the country.
Now, let me just, I just want to say this right now because I find this very interesting, that the original settlers of this region came because of the Enclosures Act, which, of course, in Europe meant the enclosing of the common, right, which was the common land designated for farming for people who weren't landowners to bring their animals to graze or, you know, to pursue their own small agricultural endeavors. When they were no longer allowed to do that, then they were kind of out of luck. So those people moved to they moved to northern New York or rural New York. They moved to Virginia. They moved to a whole host of places in the states. But I think it's very interesting now that you're talking about how that, that county became Kingdom of the Cow. And 75 years later, it's another question of land use, as you were saying when we spoke earlier this week, that is causing it not to be the Kingdom of the Cow anymore.
Absolutely. You know, I think the Enclosure Acts, which began in the early days of Industrial Revolution, and you know, what they really were trying to do is make the rural landscape in Scotland safe for the sheep and unsafe for people. And people were given approximately half an hour to leave their homes, and then they were evicted. They went to the cities, became part of Dickens tales, or they came down to the seaside, to the docks, and literally sold themselves to get passage to the New World, where many, most of the people that came to Delaware County landed in Connecticut, and they were literally auctioned off, could not leave their masters who purchased them for 13 years. It's an important part of American history that is not well understood, but it basically was the whole concept of absentee ownership of land and land tenure. And you know, people do not have much of a historical concept of land tenure. And for thousands upon thousands and thousands of years, land was held in common. And the idea of ownership, private ownership of land, is a relatively recent thing in the history of humanity. And we still have in this country things like the Boston Commons, which were common pastures. So those concepts of common ownership of land, people no longer even think about. And what has happened here in Delaware County is that as the, to some extent, as the milk price in real dollars diminished, farmers were having difficulty making a go of it because most of the farms, by geography alone and the lay of the land, had to be relatively small. And
because, so like, unlike the Midwest or the West Coast, where you have these giant sort of sweeping plains where you can contain hundreds or even thousands or even tens of thousands of cows, in Delaware County, you have these hilly parcels ideal for probably 50 cows at a time.
That would be probably perfect, 35 to 50 cows. The problem with all of that is that you cannot put together a beginning dairy farm business plan, which includes the purchase of land, and take it to a bank and make a go of it. And part of that is caused by the whole concept of land tenure, in that 63% of the parcels of land in Delaware County are owned as second properties by people whose primary residence is the New York metropolitan area. So, once again, Delaware County, which has very low income as a county goes, ends up being the victims, if you will, of absentee land ownership. And it's really kind of a shame because at the same time, the very same people that buy and purchase these second homes really are great advocates of regional food production. But by the mere fact of purchasing a second home, they prohibit that from happening. You know, in Switzerland, you can be a multi-millionaire, as the Formula One race car driver Schumacher owned 40 acres of farmland in Switzerland and wanted to build a house on it. He could not do it.
Really?
That's exactly right, you know, because Switzerland sees agriculture as part of their national defense. Another way of looking at that is the food supply is part of national defense. And we have become so globalized that it's very easy, for people to think that you can lose a food supply that is regional, local, it doesn't matter, because somewhere, someplace on earth, some poor person will be willing to supply the food to put on the shelves so the consumer can buy it.
Well, that's very interesting because as we spoke about earlier in the week when we were kind of talking about ideas for this show, a lot of the reason that rural farmland has become things or has become subdivisions or things other than rural farmland was partially based on government policy designed to give people different sort of tax credits or tax incentives to move their farms elsewhere, further away from cities. So that's one thing. And then the other thing is that, you know, it's a sort of matter of, and I mean, I don't know, I've been thinking a lot about this lately, but it is a matter of course, national security to have a pretty well-developed food supply. I was talking with somebody the other day who was talking about China. And, you know, of course, everyone's talking about China these days because they're making such a splash in the world economy and everything. But they said that 85% of their population are still farmers and less than 2% of the U.S. population, and you correct me if I'm wrong because I'm sure you know the statistic better than I do, are farmers. And so if you're talking about national security, hello, that's pretty, you know, that's a pretty big gap in, we're putting a lot of our trust in places and in people that we have really no real connection to.
Exactly. I think it's actually a little bit less than 2% now. And, you know, most people in America are 2 to 3 generations away from producing their own food. And many people might have a garden and appreciate all that goes into it. But you know, I recently was in Chicago and had a cab ride with a fellow from Ethiopia who reminded me how much effort goes into simply eating in countries like Ethiopia, you know, gathering your food, gathering your water and all of that. Things that Americans simply take for granted. I don't think we should so much take it for granted. And I do believe that you could make a very logical policy statement saying that the public has an interest in their food supply, i.e. dairy and dairy products.
Absolutely.
That really goes beyond their consciousness. There's a public's interest, I think, in a regionally dispersed, resilient food supply, and we don't have that. And
no.
What we were talking about earlier, had to do with the real estate around suburban Los Angeles, in which many of the farms sold for millions of dollars, and IRS tax code 1031 allowed those people to take those millions of dollars without paying any capital gains, move up to Central Valley, Tulare area, or New Mexico, or Idaho, and start farms of 5,000 or 10,000 cows. So,
and those farms, of course, which are the CAFO operations, which now are some of the biggest polluters on the planet, producing tons of methane gas from all the manure pits and contaminating water supplies and all these things. So, the sort of, I don't know, ill effects go on and on.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, there is a 0.74 correlation between the real estate value in L.A. and around L.A., Riverside and San Bernardino County, and milk production nationally. And one thing that isn't talked about with the number of farms that are exiting now with the current low milk price is there will not be that external capital, you know, coming from real estate to boost milk production back up. And so if it goes low, it will be extremely difficult. But there's plenty of money in the marketing chain to provide farms with good, reasonable, middle-class incomes. I have a friend in northern Vermont, and maybe some of your listeners might be familiar with Jack and Ann Laser. They have Butterworks Farm in Westfield, Vermont.
Right, and, right around the corner from one of my favorite cheesemakers, Lainey Fondeller of Lazy Lady Farm.
Oh, I know her. Yeah.
She buys some of their milk, actually, in the wintertime.
Right. She's wonderful. She's off the grid, you know, no...
Wind and solar-powered farm, certified organic cheesemaker.
And a windmill. Yeah. Well, Jack and Ann actually have a windmill as well, but... You know, they have 11, 12, 13 employees that are paid reasonably good wages.
Wow.
Some are even paid whole health care costs. And this is on a herd of 38, generally 38 Jerseys. Sometimes it's 37, sometimes it's 40.
Wow. Well, now, listen, I'm so sorry. I have to interrupt for 2 seconds. We have to just take a quick, short break. But when we come back, I want to talk about why that farm model exists in Vermont and sort of the hopeful parts about how we can get back to those kinds of sustainable small farms in the very near future, hopefully. Stay with us on Cutting the Curd. We'll be back in just a second. Welcome back to Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Ann Saxelby, and my guest today is John Bunting, milker of cows and dairy farmer advocate. You should add to this. I'm not sure all the different good works that you do, but I know that you're involved in many things.
Well, I have my own dairy blog. I should probably put in a line for that. If you just go to Google and type my name in, John Bunting, it'll be the first or second thing.
What's the name of your blog?
Well, it's John Bunting's dairyjournal.blogspot. But if you just type in my name, you'll get there pretty fast.
And as I did, it's a wonderful source. And you also contribute to other people's blogs, notably the Milkweed, isn't that right? The Milkweed is one of those.
Yeah, Milkweed is actually a physical print publication. You know, Pete Harden, who owns the Milkweed, which carries no advertisement at all. We pretty much are able to say whatever we want to say without worrying about losing advertisers. So, you know, I tell people it's the only investigative journal in all of dairy farming. It's probably the most subscribed to dairy publication in Washington, D.C. Large numbers of law firms, needless to say, subscribed to the Milkweed. Large number of processors because... You know, most of the trade publications are really sort of self-promoting of certain agendas, and, you know, so they tend to find things out that they don't tend to find out. In a recent issue, we listed the incomes or the salaries paid to some of the people that theoretically are paid to help dairy farmers' income.
What are you allowed to divulge any of that? I mean, this is also an independent station.
With commercial farmers, every hundredweight of milk, which is how milk is sold by 100 pounds, which is about 11.62 gallons, the farmers have to contribute. It's mandated by law to contribute to what's called a checkoff program or dairy promotion program, which in theory is supposed to promote the consumption of dairy products, which I think in today's world, I don't know whether we really need to be promoting dairy products or simply getting people to eat quality, whatever it is. But in any event, the CEO of that program, which you have to realize that this is 2009 to 2010, in which dairy farmers are suffering just massively financially. There's, you know, not only depressions, but suicides and foreclosures. All kinds of horrible things are happening. This guy makes $700,000 a year.
That's ridiculous. That is absolutely ridiculous.
Right.
Unconscionable. It's crazy.
Absolutely. And that is dairy farmers' money that is paying that $700,000 a year salary. So, Needless to say, that's a largely talked about thing, and it's the kind of thing that you're not about to find in most general milk dairy publications.
I just really, really quickly, I just want to, this is a sort of a goofy aside, but I know that in France they're a lot more politically vocal about agricultural issues than we are in this country. And I know that the dairy prices there have not been stellar lately as well. And as a protest, I know that a lot of farmers actually got together and dumped their milk to signify, you know, the injustice that was being done to them by the government. And I can only imagine what $700,000 of milk would look like going down the drain.
That's a good way of seeing that. Yeah, and what a lot of people don't realize, and really it's an economic organizational problem, when you reduce the powerful players down to a handful, they really need this sort of centralized pricing system so that at various times you'll find a near-perfect correlation between the price in Europe and the price here in this country. They may not be the same, but they rise and fall the same. And that's because farm milk price, in spite of all the smoke screens about it, and in spite of people thinking it's complicated beyond belief, it really is determined by a handful, and I mean a small handful of traders, on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
Can you tell us a little bit about that? I mean, I'm from Chicago, and I've been by the Board of Trade, and I've seen the little, you know, flashing signs, milk, hogs, and it goes up and it goes down.
Yes. Well, it's on Wacker Drive, South Wacker Drive, I believe, and I was recently in Chicago, and I asked some native there if that was a person or an activity that street was named after. And really, what I've been to the CME and I've met with top executives, their excuse is that it's not their fault that farm milk is priced from the CME. Well, of course, it's not their fault, but they certainly are the benefactors. It's really, and I'll say this very clearly, USDA has a lot of very good people, but as an agency, it tends to be a rogue agency. And USDA attaches their formula to this thin market that is thin beyond belief. And when I say thin beyond belief, the price can go up or down without any product literally changing hands. Non-fat dry milk, which, you know, the consumer knows is powdered milk, is traded on the CME, theoretically. They began trading that in the fall of 98. Between the fall of 98 and May 23rd of 2008, exactly one load of powdered milk had been traded. That
wow.
is a thin market. It is unreal.
And so basically milk, just to bring it down to earth for a second, because it's so bizarre, milk, which is a very real thing, which is produced by a cow, it's produced constantly, but is harvested by the farmer twice a day. It is a very real and is a very perishable commodity, yet it becomes sort of diluted, powdered, processed, emulsified, and all this crap, pardon my language, that allows the milk price to, you know, just remain what it is instead of keeping it grounded in reality. And those controls, which were, I believe, put in place in the 30s or around there, were put in to protect farmers, to allow them a consistent price for their milk, even if there were fluctuations in the market, because they knew that those cows were going to produce milk regardless of the economic reality of the country. But now it's become this just completely backwards equation, and it just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, well, going back to the 30s, you know, that was a very tough time. There was a significant, maybe a third of the population in this country, working population, was unemployed. And the Roosevelt administration and others honestly realized that if they didn't do something about agriculture, that maybe the person that lost his job in the shirt factory in New York City would not have any place to go, and he might start a riot in New York City. So if you go back to the home farm, and have some square meals a day and a roof over his head. It was really in the public's interest to have that happen. So a lot of it really had to do with making certain that farmers had adequate income. And they looked at many, many means of pricing milk. And really, if you think about capitalism or the market system, the selling price of anything should be the cost of producing the goods plus a profit. That's what anyone will tell you. That's what the textbooks will tell you the selling price ought to be.
Right.
So what they ended up with as a result of years of looking at this thing with dairy is they developed the concept of parity, which was based upon the cost of inputs. And that kept the farm milk price rising, relatively speaking, at the general rate of inflation. The CPI for dairy...
CPI rose, means what?
Oh, I'm sorry. Consumer Price Index. What the public is paying for the products they're buying moved at the relative general rate of inflation. And I recently put together a graph, which will be in the next issue of the Milkweed, from 1935 right up through the present time. And right up until Ronald Reagan was president, the early days, as a matter of fact, it was his first official act after being shot by John Hinckley to sign a law which eliminated what was called parity pricing and put 100% of the milk pricing power in the hands of the buyers of milk.
Wow.
And it's just an atrocious thing. and most dairy farmers voted for Ronald Reagan not once but twice.
Wow. Oh my goodness. So all right. Well, I've spoken with our producer and our engineer, and I know that we have a lot more to talk about than our usual 30-minute show. So if you're okay with it, I think we'll take a quick break and come back for another 15-minute segment and talk about how we can back ourselves out of this this crazy scenario and maybe start to put some sense and some reality back into our dairy industry. So stay with us on Cutting the Curd. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Cutting the Curd for an unprecedented third segment. I'm your host, Ann Saxelby. Our show today is produced by Jack Inslee, engineered by Nat Wiener, and sponsored by my mom, Pam Saxelby, who writes a fabulous, funny blog about how to raise your kids and, you know, and the challenges that lie therein. http://www.saxelbypam.blogspot.com saxelbypam.blogspot.com. My guest today is John Bunting, and we're talking about the crazy world of dairy and how we can get back to a more normal, sane reality of dairy. So, John, how can we take the control away from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange and put it back into the hands of people like the Lasers of Butterworks Farm in Vermont? What do you see as some possible solutions and some beacons of hope in the dairy industry?
Well, let me say that Jack and Ann Laser, they were the first certified organic farm in Vermont. Everything that their cows eat, they raise. It's just truly a perfect example of everything that anyone wants in agriculture and dairy farming. But by the same token, it's been the result of years of an effort and work that most people are not willing to put into it, having to produce a product which is primarily yogurt and marketing and distributing it. Most farmers are very happy to forget about what happens to their milk or not think about it the minute it leaves their farm, and it's a terribly critical thing. And you know, there's a Supreme Court ruling back in the 30s, Nibia versus something or other, I forget who it was, and they said milk is closed in public interest. And that is so absolutely true, and it's become very politicized.
Yeah.
And what most people don't realize is that here in New York State, we've got basically a dysfunctional political system. A recent article in Harper's Magazine said that the New York political system was the most dysfunctional of the entire country. I don't know whether that's exactly true, but it's worth reading on anyone's part. Because really what they're saying is that it was bossism. And I've said for years that you understand New York politics by conceiving it as three men and a budget. That's what it comes down to. Well, Washington, D.C. is not much different, you know?
Well,
you have these committee heads, and to get change in D.C., which is absolutely necessary, you have to get past these committee heads, which is pretty darn hard to do. And, for instance, I was on Kirsten Gillibrand, who is now New York Senator, a Congresswoman's Ag Policy Advising Committee. And in the very first meeting, I suggested that you couldn't understand dairy without seeing it from an antitrust perspective. And her eyes lit up, and she said she'd be perfectly willing to hold antitrust hearings in the House Ag Committee, which she was on.
Wow.
Well, it didn't happen. And it didn't happen because Colin Peterson is head of the House Ag Committee.
And who's Colin Peterson?
Colin Peterson is congressman from Minnesota.
Okay.
And he is hunting fishing buddies with the former head of Dairy Farmers of America, this massively large, corrupted co-op that shouldn't even legally be a co-op. They're being sued in multiple places. A new lawsuit was just launched in the Northeast, naming DFA and Dairy Marketing Service as part of it. But nothing can get past Colin Peterson.
Well, let me just say for 2 quick seconds, I took a trip up to Sullivan County a couple weeks ago, and the dairy farmers that I was chatting with, when I asked them who they sold their milk to, they said a couple of different names of co-ops, but in the end, all those co-ops were owned by DFA. So,
exactly.
Yeah, they are. And it's very kind of, shaded, and there are nuances of, you know, they make you seem like you've got this... this more sort of local personal co-op, but in the end you don't. It is this powerful, gigantic entity that, like you said, should be subjected to antitrust lawsuits.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So,
our other senator, Schumer, just came out because Christine Varney, who is head of the antitrust division of the Department of Justice, which, by the way, is holding hearings. They will hold hearings on dairy in Madison, Wisconsin on June 25th. And that's an important step, really. I think that's possibly a good step. Hopefully it will end up being worthwhile doing. But she made some statement about taking away the antitrust exemption that co-ops have enjoyed through what's called the Capper-Volstead Act. And, my God, you know, these co-ops are just... descending upon Washington with all their lobbyists, and Chuck Schumer just came out and said that he supported full Capper-Volstead exemptions for these co-ops. Well, if you take the example of DFA, nobody can figure their books out. They are being sued in so many cases. They are partners in all kinds of organizations that the farmers don't share in. They settled with the Commodity Future Trading Act for manipulating the price on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, which was not to the farmers' benefit. They settled for a $12 million fine in December 2008. And they basically are the only show in town in the Northeast.
It's very funny. It reminds me, you know, we're talking about, I don't know, that we're drawing different sort of strains of similarity between dairy and other things. And I was thinking a lot in our conversation about, you know, Wall Street and the recent corruption that we've experienced there. And it's like, you know, the Wall Street has been deregulated. supposedly, and put in the hands of, you know, of these corrupt business people. I don't see why our dairy industry shouldn't be deregulated, but in the way that gives the power and gives the, you know, gives the power back to the farmers, you know, because USDA and all these people are obviously not in the position to help anybody right now.
Well, yeah, and that is essentially, Ann, I think, because I tell people that farm milk pricing is like religion was in the Middle Ages. It is made so complex, and most people are illiterate relative to the whole thing, that you have to go to the high priest or just leave it to the high priest and hope that your milk soul will get to heaven. But, you know, they're presently working on the next farm bill. And what they're advocating, the volatility, the up and down of milk price is just absolutely artificial. You know, if you were able to look inside the CME every day, which very few people are, you can see that a handful of traders are doing that. National Milk Producers Federation, which Jerry Kozak, who is the CEO of that, claims to represent 80% of the dairy farmers in the country. His salary is a mere $650,000. What they're proposing is a government-sponsored, but the farmers would still have to pay something, insurance program to deal with the volatility. And when the volatility is absolutely artificially created, what are we talking about here?
Sure, you know? Yeah, I'm sure their insurance policy is really going to do a great job. Yeah.
I mean, I hate to say it, but, you know, I mean, insurance is a critical thing. It's the one industry segment that didn't have any failures during the Depression. It's, you know, the insurance companies calculate the risk, add their profit, and that's what the premium is. And again, it's an important thing relative to family-sized farming of all sites. In normal years that are profitable for the typical dairy farmer, it takes all of the income from 25 cows to pay for health insurance.
Wow.
I mean, one of the first things that could happen that would help would be if we had a real health care system in this country, which, again, what appears to be happening is something that the insurance companies will benefit from.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to get horribly political with you. But
No, it's absolutely necessary. But so wait, as long as we're being political, let's talk about Vermont again. Let's talk about Vermont and why Vermont is different from New York. How does Vermont work politically that allows their dairy farmers to enjoy such a better, I think, just more opportunities, more resources, and better, you know, but more profits than New York State dairy farms?
Well, that's fairly much true, I think part of it is that Vermont does not have this sort of upstate downstate thing that New York does. You know, you get when Chuck Schumer was a congressman representing metropolitan New York, he was all for the cheaper the milk price, the better it would be. Now, as senator representing rural milk, you know, he may advocate that farmers need this and that and so forth, but. You know, in Vermont, a typical meeting of the legislature, you'll go in there and you'll see people with flannel shirts on, you know. There's hardly a person in the Vermont legislature that doesn't know a dairy farmer personally or related to a dairy farmer or perhaps even a dairy farmer.
Yeah.
So, you know, really what we're talking about here, Ann, is a matter of information, and I don't even want to use the term education, but the people in the legislature in Vermont are informed people relative to the agriculture that exists in Vermont. By and large, the people in the New York State legislature are not truly informed people.
And so how do they turn that into action? How do they turn that into results for Vermont dairy farmers? Are there government programs? Are there grants? Do they help them with capital costs, starting up new operations? How do they help the government?
Well, I can, you know, right now they're talking about losing a significant number of farms in Vermont. So, you know, we can't talk right now about that. But as you know, Lainey Fondelier is a small farmer that produces a very wonderful cheese. And, you know, the difference between the approval process in Vermont for a small-scale cheesemaker, and the approval process in New York State is just light years different, you know?
Interesting.
And Vermont wanted to kind of clamp down early on Laney, and they had a hearing, and 250 people showed up to support her, you know?
Wow.
That just doesn't happen in New York State. And New York State Department of Ag and Markets really sees their job more or less as a state trooper would be. It's to stop something from happening. Whereas, you know, a couple of commissioners ago, they had a guy who was head of the dairy division who told me at one time he literally had gone to the bank for more than one time to ask the bank to loan money to farmers who wanted to start making their milk into a dairy product.
Mm-hmm.
That has never once happened in New York State. Not once.
Wow.
You know, and part of it is the paranoia that people have. Oh, well, if we have this little guy making things, you know.
Oh, yeah. God forbid someone touches our food with their hands, you know. Like, that would just be the worst. We have to make sure it's made in a sterile factory where, you know, everything's done by machines. And if there's one glitch, then everything goes, you know, straight to hell.
And there's paranoia about raw milk, and you must see it relative to raw milk cheese. But, you know, the fact of the matter is, every 6 minutes a person in this country dies from some medically induced accident or infection. You know?
That may be the result of them eating processed food to begin with.
Exactly. You know, but the government never says, stay away from hospitals, don't go to hospitals. And I don't think you've got a clock that is graduated in enough increments to say how often anyone even gets sick from a raw milk dairy product.
So let me say this. I was thinking about possible solutions for this problem, and I was thinking that the main gaps for me, as far as I see it, are in distribution and an entrepreneurship, and a little bit in government assistance for small farms, government backing small scale local processing and things like that. So, possible solutions that I see: one is raw milk sales, which we talked about, because a farmer being able to sell raw milk from their farm allows them to capture all of that profit instead of putting it into the co-op. However, the problem with that is that the farmer then has to fill that gap of distribution and how to get that product to market. I was just, as I said, in Sullivan County a couple weeks ago, and we visited a wonderful farm, and I'm kicking myself. I can't remember the name right now, but I will update it on my blog, that is licensed to sell raw milk. And they sell about 20 gallons of raw milk a week. And that kind of a solution, though they've done everything right, and though they're legal and they're selling raw milk off the farm, that is not an economic solution for their farm. So there needs to be, if you know, raw milk is to be a solution, there also has to be some component of distribution that's going to be included in that. Another solution that I see is collective processing. We've been talking a lot recently, Patrick Martins and I, about starting some sort of a creamery in Sullivan County that would collect milk from local dairy farms and turn it into a simple cheese, a simple but delicious cheese that could reach market at around, you know, $8 a pound for the consumer. And I think that, you know, having a small-scale processing facility, or many small-scale processing facilities in New York, actually, could be another solution. Progressive land use and farmland conservation initiatives. Again, this is, you probably know tons more than I do about this, but the government sort of taking control a little bit of how our land is used and putting farming first for once as opposed to last. I think that could help a lot. And then finally, more markets. I think we're lucky in New York City that we have the Green Market as a place to go get great, fresh, locally grown seasonal food. But more local, regional and public markets, I think, need to be developed. There's a great project in New York right now called New Amsterdam Public, which is a market that's trying to revive the South Street Seaport, which used to be a thriving public market, as a place for people to sell their goods. I think that, you know, the burden, like you were saying before, people like the Lasers at Butterworks Farm are incredibly progressive. But in building the kind of business that they do, they take on all the burden of producing the product, of distributing the product, of marketing the product. And there are steps in that that can be sort of taken out if we kind of revive all of those things along the way. Collective processing, creating markets where purveyors sell the products, and giving farmers, you know, just more, or people, giving people more incentive to farm by, making that land available to them. That's my spiel. Those are my...
Well, I think you've said that very well, Anne. And in Sullivan County, and I really should look at it a bit more, Rick Bishop, who used to be with the Watershed Ag Council, literally put together a portable milk processing thing in a trailer basis, which farmers could borrow for a certain amount of time to do some sort of market thing to see if they want to progress any further with that. And I really should look into that a bit further. He's with the Sullivan County Planning Department, I believe.
Yeah, the cheesemobile.
Yeah. Right. So we need that. We need one more thing I would add. We need a land-grant university that is Cornell in New York State.
Thank you. Absolutely. Yes.
That is friendly to the ideas that you just put forth, instead of antagonistic.
Or just teaching people the industrial way, get big or get out, which has pretty much been the party line for however many years now.
Yeah, well, one-third of the income of Cornell comes from the public, and two-thirds they have to go out and find. And so you really have to look at that metric there and see, is that really the kind of thing we want? If we had more public support of Cornell, then the public should have a voice as to what direction that should be going in, as opposed to, Cornell was the lead land-grant university in developing bovine growth hormone, or GMO bovine growth hormone. So there's an example of Monsanto
co-opting
funding
a university. Yeah.
Yeah. There you go. But I think your thoughts are right on target. I think the public, too, needs to become much more informed about their food supply system. There are no sort of silver bullets to any of this, and yet I think we are approaching something. If it's not crisis level, it's certainly going to be chaotic at some point.
Go ahead.
the public can do well to inform themselves, not necessarily in terms of solutions, but exactly what is happening, And if you go to third world countries, and I know, because I know a young woman who's moved with her parents when she was two to this country, and they took her mother to a supermarket on the first day they were going to go shopping for something. She took one quick look around the supermarket and said, "Get me out of here. This isn't food." What we've done here in America is little by little, the public has really lost a sense as to what real food is about. So that would help if the public sets about informing themselves relative to real food.
Well, I'm sorry to say that we're kind of running out of time here today, but that's a hopeful note to end on. And I think that, being more involved, being more informed, following the Vermont model of getting 250 people to the, to the state legislature to help people like Lainey Fondiller, make her cheese operation a viable and real thing. That's a great thing, and food in the end is it's about, of course, nourishment and survival, but it's also about community, and I think the more we build that up, the more hopeful our local food picture will be for the future. So thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me this afternoon, and I hope we can have you back on for subsequent shows.
It would be my pleasure.
All right. So thank you so much. And we'll see you again next Sunday on Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network.
You're listening to Cutting the Curd, hosted by Anne Saxelby.